killed the Tsar and its ministers. Anastasia screamed in vain. I rode a tank, held a generous rank. When the blitzkrieg raged and the bodies sank.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Nada Hashimi, who's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies, and the co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashimi.
Glad to be with you again.
And the meeting between the Syrian beleaguered and besieged Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and the chief security or head of Iran's security, Saeed Jalili, obviously the Iranian declarations coming out of that, that Iran's pledging support for a vital partner. Just separate the rhetoric from the reality, if you can, Nader. What can Iran do to rescue Assad?
Well, there's not much that they can do to, I think, save the Assad regime, whose days are really numbered. And it's not a question of if the regime will fall, but really, you know, just when. So I think the regime is there to pledge sort of support to its closest ally in the region. Of course, there's an issue of these 48 Iranian alleged pilgrims, and I put pilgrims in quotation marks because it's not really clear how many of them are legitimate pilgrims and how many of them are representatives and agents of the Islamic Republican Guard Corps. So, Iran has sent a high-level representative, effectively a spokesperson, a person who's been personally chosen by Iran's supreme leader to act as his representative in Syria to pledge support to the Assad regime. So I don't think there's much that it can do. The big question that we don't know, and we probably won't know until the Assad regime falls, is to what extent that the Iranian regime has actually been supporting the Syrian regime. It's generally assumed that there's been considerable, significant, and deep support, but the extent and the depth of that support is unknown, largely because both countries are, you know, repressive, authoritarian regimes, and there's not an open paper trail.
Well, Mr. Jalili, the Iran's security chief, said that Iran will not allow the axis of resistance to be broken in any way. Now, apparently, the Axis resistance refers to Iran, Syria, Hezbollah, and the Palestinian group Hamas in Gaza, which I understand Hamas is already breaking away from Iran's orbit.
That's true. Yeah, they've moved their offices out of Damascus, and they're moving to Cairo. So you're right. That's what the axis of resistance means in the rhetoric of the Iranian regime. Effectively means those countries and those political forces that are allied with the Islamic Republic of Iran. But what's, of course, lost in that phrase, the axis of resistance, is it assumes that there's only one form of resistance that's acceptable. In other words, the assumption is that the only form of resistance is resistance to Western and European and Israeli policy in the region, ignoring the fact that the bigger issue that I think the people of the region are now facing as a result of the Arab Spring is that there's another force that needs to be resisted, and that's the political tyrannies that rule over the peoples of the Middle East, of which Bashar Assad's regime is probably the most notorious, given its crimes against humanity and war crimes that it's been inflicting over its own citizens over the last 17 months. But that form of resistance, of course, does not bother the clerics in Iran. They're very, very comfortable in perpetuating and supporting the Assad regime. So it's really, you know, if one wants to just take a step back, it's really an attempt by the Iranian government to come to the support of its closest ally. One of the dimensions of the Syrian conflict, And it's important to state that the primary, most important, you know, founding, I think, issue with respect to Syria is the fact that there's a popular struggle against the 42-year-old dictatorship. But there's also a regional dynamic that's sort of fueling this conflict, and that is the rivalry between the Islamic Republic of Iran and its allies, and Saudi Arabia and its allies in the region. And the big sort of key event here that has shifted the balance of power was the 2003 American invasion of Iraq that resulted in the rise of Shi'i political parties that are friendly toward Iran. And I think the Saudis and their allies in the Gulf Cooperation Council are hoping that by overthrowing Assad, they can readjust that balance of power, remove an important ally from Iran's camp and shift it back into the Saudi camp.
Again, I'm speaking with Nader Hashimi. He's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. So we don't really know the extent. We know that the Saudis are furious with the George W. Bush regime for taking down the Sunni dictatorship in Iraq and allowing essentially Iran to replace it through a very friendly Shia regime in Baghdad that we, the United States, essentially installed with at the cost of great blood and treasure. Now, Iraq has been fairly unstable since then, and I'm just wondering the extent to which the Saudi hand is in that destabilization, allegedly the hands of al-Qaeda, but you know, how do all these fighters suddenly show up in Syria, you know, from Chechnya and all over the place? I mean,
you're right. I mean, it's important to realize that the bulk of the Free Syrian Army, the overwhelming majority of the men who are involved in the armed resistance against the Assad regime, are local citizens of Syria, people who have organized themselves in their own communities and they're fighting a tyrannical regime. But part of the story, and I think this gets often exaggerated in terms of the extent of the support, is there is a radical jihadi Salafi sort of current that is at play here. They're responsible for their own human rights violations. They've come over from the border in Iraq where they have been involved in their own militant activity over the last 10 years approximately. And it's also this conflict, because it's been ongoing, because it's been unresolved, has been a magnet. It's become another sort of Afghanistan in many ways, recruiting and drawing in radical elements from across the Islamic world, very much in a similar way to the way Afghanistan did during the 1980s. And it's a lot of these sort of radical groups that have been responsible for arresting foreign nationals, for perpetuating atrocities, for some extremist activity. And this sort of highlights, I think, the fact that the longer this conflict in Syria goes unresolved, the more it destabilizes Syria, the more it acts as a magnet for these extremist groups who can gather there to perpetuate and pursue their own radical ideology. And the tragedy of this, of course, is it, of course, undermines and it tarnishes the very important popular struggle that's being waged by the majority of Syrians against the family dictatorship run by the Assad family.
So let's turn, Nader Hashimi, to the capture of 48 Iranian so-called pilgrims by the Free Syrian Army, or elements of the Free Syrian Army. Already the same head of Iran's National Security Council that we've been speaking about, Mr. Jalili, said that he will use all means possible to win their freedom. Apparently, the Iranians have sent a letter to the U.S. administration accusing them of being the manifest sponsor of terrorist groups in Syria and holding the U.S. responsible for the captive's safety. Apparently, some of these so-called pilgrims have been killed by the Syrian army, who are bombarding wherever it is they're being held. What's your sense? I mean, first of all, I can't understand how religious pilgrims could show up in a country at war. That doesn't ring true.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, it's highly irresponsible of the Islamic Republic of Iran to send pilgrims into the middle of a war zone. Now, granted that the conflict in Syria over the last month or so has significantly deteriorated, parts of the country, if you follow the news reports, seem perfectly calm. Others, like the city of Aleppo today as we speak, are war zones. So, I mean, there's a question here as to why did the Islamic Republic send pilgrims to the middle of an ongoing civil war? And then the second big question is, who exactly constitutes this group of pilgrims? Are they legitimate pilgrims, or are they agents and members of Iran's Islamic Republican Guard Corps? I suspect that it's a combination of both. Iran has huge, you know, strategic interests in Syria. It's very convenient for the regime to send its agents to Syria under the guise of being pilgrims. That's a sort of a convenient cover. But of course, it wouldn't be a surprise to me or any, I think, serious analyst to think that part of this group constitutes people who are involved with Iran's military and security intelligence services, who are really up to no good. They're effectively in Syria to preserve and support a criminal regime that's perpetuating gross atrocities on its own population. So in that sense, I think the Iranian regime has a lot to answer for, especially if it can be proven that the part of this group constitutes members of the Islamic Republican Guard Corps.
Well, previously I've spoken with a number of representatives of the Free Syrian Army, at least the political representatives, and for some time now they've been saying that Iran is in many ways directing Assad's response to the insurrection, and Iranian drones are being used, etc. I don't know, you know, obviously you can't entirely trust what either side's saying in this civil war.
Right.
But this is not exactly news, the involvement of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. Apparently they, some time ago, when the insurrection first started, they brought in monitoring equipment that tracks down cell phones and websites, etc., and identifies critics of the regime. And, of course, we know what a grisly end will happen to anybody who opposes the Assads.
Right. Yeah, well, several points here. One, first and foremost, the Assad regime does not need help from anyone in the world, particularly Iran, in terms of how to crack down on political opposition within Syria. They have a very long and sordid track record of dealing with their own population in a very brutal manner. So they don't really need any lessons here or help from Iran. So I think the claims that somehow that the Iranian regime or the Revolutionary Guard Corps of the Islamic Republic are somehow directing the war against the Free Syrian Army and the Arab Spring Uprising is exaggerated. The second point is we don't really know the extent and the depth of Iranian involvement. I suspect that it's quite deep, and I suspect that Iran has brought to Syria, as you just indicated, a lot of the lessons that it has learned from the crackdown on the Green Movement in Iran in 2009, particularly the ability of the Iranian regime to track internet transmissions, cell phone transmissions, to locate where the opposition is organizing and coalescing, and to really crack down hard. That's what the Iranian regime did with a lot of ruthlessness and efficiency in 2009, 2010, and I think it's been sharing that technology with the Syrian regime. The good news in all of this is that it seems not to be working in the case of Syria, that despite the best efforts of the Islamic Republic of Iran to support its ally in Damascus, that they have been they've had a very difficult time in really, you know, cracking down and preventing the uprising from continuing. So, I mean, that's my reading on the level of interaction and support. I think we're going to have to really wait until there are democratic transitions in both Syria and Iran, and there's an opening of the archives, and people are willing to come forward without fear and can really reveal to, you know, future historians, to the general public, exactly what was taking place, the type and depth and the extent of the relations between Assad in Syria and Khamenei in Iran with respect to collaboration on questions of intelligence gathering, crackdown, opposition work, etc. So we really don't know, but I think it's important to not exaggerate the extent here of the role that Iran is playing. It's an ally, it's supporting them, but, you know, it's clearly not directing or as I said before, the Syrian regime does not need to take any lessons from, you know, Iran in terms of how to treat its own population. It's done quite a sufficient and very ruthless job over the last 42 years.
Again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashimi. He's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Kobel School of International Studies at the University of Denver, and the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future. Now, we mentioned earlier that Iran has essentially lost out with Hamas, who have largely transitioned to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt for their support and mentorship, if you will. But my understanding, talking to people in Lebanon, is that Hezbollah is also losing out with its sympathy. For some time, Hezbollah had gained the respect of a lot of people in Lebanon, including some of its traditional enemies, because they were the ones that were standing up against Israel. Apparently, that's been considerably tarnished because of their support for the Assads. Refugees are pouring in from Syria, and they're not too happy about what's happening there. What's your understanding about what's going to happen to Hezbollah when the Assads fall? Let's start with that question.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. I mean, you're putting your finger on a very important development that has been taking place here. And that is the loss in prestige and support and popularity that the Islamic Republic of Iran had and that Hezbollah had within the broader Sunni Arab world. Hezbollah and Iran, to a lesser extent, were considered to be, you know, champions of resistance, champions of the human rights and the political rights of the Palestinians. And you know, if you look at opinion polls not too long ago, Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, was the most popular Arab political leader. Ahmadinejad sort of, you know, was up there in support, as was Hafez Assad, largely because of their, you know, support for Hezbollah and support for the Palestinians and their resistance to Israeli policies in the region. But as a result of the Arab Spring and as a result of the crackdown in Syria, and as a direct result of a political decision that both Hezbollah and the leaders in Iran have taken to support the Assad regime as opposed to the opposition on the streets of Syria, they've lost a lot of credibility and support. And this is a huge blow to the prestige of Hezbollah, which at one time could claim to sort of stand on some moral high ground. Now it's actually on the other side of the so-called resistance or democratic barricades because of its support for Assad's regime. And so this is going to actually lead to considerable, I think, regional transformations. It's going to reorient the political map of the Middle East. It'll have huge consequences for Hezbollah's role in the politics of Lebanon and the politics of the broader Arab world. And of course, with respect to Iran is, I think, one of the things it's so fearful and why I think it's one of the big losers in the Arab Spring, is because Iran has invested a lot of time and money and energy in reaching out and telling the Sunni Arab world that we are the legitimate sort of leaders of the Islamic world. We are the ones who are standing up for the plight of the Palestinians and the plight of the Lebanese, not the other leaders of the Middle East. But now, because of its very vocal stance, as we see today, you know, with respect to what is happening in Damascus as we speak, Iran has made a decision, and it's made a decision that has basically put it against the tide of popular opinion within the Arab world, which is strongly supportive of the uprising in Syria and strongly critical of those governments, those forces that are supporting the Assad regime. So this is going to have serious consequences for both Hezbollah and Iran in the coming years.
Well, of course, there is a red line in this, from my understanding, and that is that if the Assads were to transfer some or all of their chemical arsenal, say, to Hezbollah, that might invite Israeli intervention. Of course, remember, during the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein tried to pick a fight with the Israelis by firing Scud missiles in the hope that Israel would intervene against him and therefore destroy the coalition led by the United States. Is there a possibility of any repeat along those lines?
No, I think those claims about, you know, chemical weapons in Syria falling into the wrong hands, possibly falling into the hands of Hezbollah, which then they can use against Israel, thus widening this conflict. I think those claims are completely exaggerated and distorted, and for one primary reason. Hezbollah does not need to rely on Syria to obtain chemical weapons. It can rely on its closest ally and supporter, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has its own chemical weapons capabilities. It could easily give those chemical weapons to Hezbollah without even involving Syria, perhaps at best as a transport route, but there's other ways of, getting armaments to Hezbollah. So I think this is an exaggerated claim that, and a distortion, I think, of really of what really matters in this conflict. I think those chemical weapons are in the hands of the Assad regime, and the big question is not whether they'll end up in the hands of Hezbollah, but whether in its dying days the regime in Damascus will use chemical weapons on its own civilians in order to preserve itself. That's, I think, the big question.
Well, just in closing, Nader Hashemi, obviously there are some attempts probably going on behind the scenes, one would imagine, to ease Assad out of there and give him asylum. Russia, of course, seems to be the number one candidate for that. Do you think that there is anything that's going to happen between the kind of Gotterdammerung, Samson option of bringing the whole thing down, including using chemical weapons on the part of the Assads, or will, I know he's delusional and he's not too bright apparently, but do you think at some point or other, when the writing's on the wall, he'll figure, I can go off and live somewhere with my billions that I've stolen from the Syrian people?
It's a good question, it's a good question. No one, I think, really knows the answer to that question. Will Bashar Assad's fate be that of Tunisia's Ben Ali, where he flees with his millions and ends up in some safe country, or will he suffer the fate of Muammar Gaddafi, where he's pulled out of some sewer and he's killed by an enraged group of his own citizens? We're not. I think it's too early to speculate on that. It's a good question. If he does decide to flee, he really has two places to go. Possibly Russia. The other is the Islamic Republic of Iran. But of course, if Iran takes him in, that further entrenches and diminishes Iran's regional credibility on the Arab street, because it's effectively holding and coddling this man who's viewed as a tyrant. And that's not in Iran's long-term strategic interest. So, how this regime is going to come to an end and where its head of state is going to end up is open to speculation. And I think no one really knows the answer to that. I think we just have to wait and see.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Nader Hashemi.
Glad to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's a professor of Middle East and Islamic politics at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of Islam, Secularism, and Liberal Democracy, Towards a Democratic Theory for Muslim Societies. And he's the co-editor of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, and The Struggle for Iran's Future. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the Hospital Corporation of America has been defrauding Medicare and endangering the lives of their patients.
Time and time and time we see these acts against humanity. While each for each and each world leader shed blood for what they each believe. On and on and on we go. Well, some will you see, some won't be. True for you and truth will lead you to a sense of heart.